Listen.
Listen.
The world is talking. The World Talk Radio Variety Channel.
Are listening to the Power Sport Flying Radio Show here with Roy Beiswanger. When we return, Jim Sweeney will join us, and Jim has been making a study of the changes to the sport pilot rules, and actually to the point of listening to what everybody has to say, and he has assimilated a lot of information. What we're going to do is we're going to focus in on some of what he's learned here over the past month or so, and what we're going to do is talk about the Part 61 stuff, the pilot certification things that have to do with the new changes, and we're going to tie it into what is already existing in the old rule, and we're going to do it all right here on the Pirate Sport Flying Radio Show.
Don't just aviate. Participate! For more than 50 years, EAA has encouraged participation in aviation, helping you realize your dreams of flight. The new EAA Sport Pilot and Light Sport Aircraft magazine offers you the exciting world of buying, flying, building, maintaining, and having fun with ultralights and light sport aircraft. Join EAA today and begin your adventure. Call toll-free 800-JOIN-EAA or visit us online at eaa.org.
AirTech has everything you need for your ultralight aircraft. Communications equipment from Lynx and Comtronics. Ram mounts to install any GPS or radio to any surface. Fuel tanks, wheel pants, strobe lights, throttle cables, and much, much more. Also, your source for the RK400 centrifugal clutch. Reduce engine wear and make your engine easier to start with a clutch. Your engine will idle smooth at low RPMs. AirTech has been providing quality technical assistance to Quicksilver customers for over 20 years. Contact them today at airtech.com.
Ultraflight Magazine. Get the one magazine that proudly supports all of the powered sport aviation world. From powered paragliders through the new exciting light sport aircraft offerings, Ultraflight Magazine covers it all. Keep up on the sport, the rules, and news for everything ultralight and sport pilot. Up-to-date news, breathtaking tutorials, and informative columnists make Ultraflight Magazine the one magazine worth reading. Get your subscription today by visiting ultraflight.com.
Hey, you are listening. You are listening. We're back. This is the Power Sport Flying Radio Show. This is Roy Beiswanger, and with us, Jim Sweeney from Sweeney Corp, also from the IUAC. We didn't give you enough credit for that last time, but you're actually one of the big organizers of the safety seminar yourself. And this has been kind of a post-safety seminar show, including yourself. So welcome aboard.
We had a good seminar.
It was, you know what, it was, they're always a ton of work, and they're always one of these things that is just a, but it's just a ton of work. And, but this is an example of a year where it was wrapped up, everything went really, really smoothly, great volunteers all the way through, of course, you were there to help, all the speakers were there, we had Dan Stessel. We had Marty Pileski, Vicky was there to help out with things, of course, the folks from the state. And you know, when you get enough good people in, working at things, good things are going to happen. But, you know, the one thing we didn't do, we didn't thank Earl for, or I didn't thank, you know, here I am pulling you into, you know, my shame. We didn't thank him for the award that he got, Frank. We should talk a little bit about that.
Frank, the original one, one of the original guys there. 30 years is a long time,
right?
And this there's a lot of similarity between the way that this safety seminar came up and what was happening up at EAA and down on the farm at the same time. And we had the aircraft that Frank was flying in; those things were obviously featured in the early at the ultralight section at Oshkosh, and there's a lot of similarity between the ultralight board on EAA and the people that were the original founders of this thing.
Right.
So I thought it was appropriate as EAA and Earl made that presentation of the plaque to Frank for his many years of service.
Yes, Frank, and all this stuff is overdue. I mean, frankly, and that was not a pun meant to, but honestly, people shouldn't have to wait 30 years. he's been plugging at it for 30 years, not just down here, but out on the out there on the farm there up there at Oshkosh. And he's been literally a big voice for aviation. And a lot of this was overdue. But what was neat about it is he walked away with three plaques. And it was actually really, really neat because it was from three separate constituencies, I guess, if you will, and certainly three different groups of people that had a lot to thank him for. The first one he got for the day was from the Gateway Ultralight. Gateway Area Ultralight Association. I know there's four letters. I had to figure out which way they went together, and they came up with a really nice deal for him, and that was the first presentation. State of Illinois did real well. The Division of Aeronautics presented him with a very nice plaque. And then when Frank thought everything was settled down, that's when, at the end of his presentation, Earl ambushed him with yet another award, which is a good way to get ambushed, I suppose.
There you go. Yeah, there's another thing here. As the safety seminars go, for a large number of those 30 years that Frank has been active,
mm-hmm.
He has not only presented with our safety seminar, the Illinois Ultralight Safety Seminar, but has been the voice in the MC at a number of the other safety seminars that have been throughout the Midwest.
Darn good point. The Wisconsin, the Indiana, and I know there's been one or two others that have come and gone, but you're right. He helped nurture those things, helped get them going, and eventually, and this is where the Illinois boys, I guess, were a little slower than the rest. We have a good thing, and we just keep going with it. A lot of the others actually transitioned over and started training their own homegrown talent. Well, we kind of kept Frank at the millstone until he absolutely said, hey, guys, 30 years. So it was all good. I mean, that was a good part of, I think, the show, and it's one of the parts that made me feel real good about it, too. So, but anyway, one of the presentations we had came from Paul Hamilton, and of course you attended that, and you have read the rule, you've read the preamble, you've listened to what Earl's had to say about things, and I mean you've really made, and this is what I like about you, you really have made a study of all this stuff. And one of the things that you've told me before is every time you hear somebody talk about this thing, there seems to be yet another little wrinkle that that maybe somebody else left out or somebody else didn't see. And so you're just going to iron this thing whole out for us, right?
Well, I'm not sure about ironing, but there is quite a bit to, as small as it was or as subtle as it was, there was still quite a bit to it. And
mm-hmm.
The intent on this thing initially had been to correct those things that it was not intended in the first place.
Right.
Left hand, right hand, who was doing what. And there were some things that, I don't know, I think still remain that we hope will come up in futures. But, and a number of the things had to do with even Part 43, Part 91, things that were different than what we're going to talk about here, Part 61. So we're just looking at the elements as it pertains right here.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most confusing elements in Sport Pilot was the make, model, set.
Yes.
And general aviation has category, class, and type, and which far exceeds the need for Sport Pilot. And as the rule was originally being put together, there was quite a bit of discussion about a student's ability to transition from one make model in a given category to a different make model in the same category.
Right.
And so we're not even worried about jumping categories per se. And that was the reason for the make model set, because of what the manufacturers were very concerned with, the significant, in their minds, differences between their aircraft and somebody else's aircraft.
Sure.
As the time has progressed, we've seen that there are probably now more similarities rather than differences,
right,
between the make models. And the number of logbook endorsements that a sport pilot could acquire over time as he changed from aircraft to aircraft could have also been significant. So one of the first changes actually came right at the very beginning, where in the NPRM they talked about make, model, and type.
Mm-hmm.
They changed it or defined it better to make, model, set, where a set represented aircraft that had similar flying characteristics.
Right.
But even within that, there was a chart that was in the government publications, and it showed the number of endorsements that somebody might actually require if they were going to hit all of the make, model, set requirements.
Right.
So, in a word, that's all gone.
Yes. And you know what? And just your explanation of what it was makes me that much more thankful that it is no more.
It simplified itself a little bit in that as you began to look from category to category to category and then looked at the make, model, sets within the category, a lot of it had to do with landing gear.
Right.
And in the case of the powered parachutes, it had to do with canopies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, as I remember, the one that probably had the simplest initially was weight shift, although landing gear was added to that. So that having gone away now, the things that we're concerned about is land and sea. So you now have endorsements for the aircraft for land operation, and you have the endorsement for sea operation.
Sure.
And that goes in terms with the Part 23 aircraft or the general aviation aircraft also. There's always been that distinction between being able to handle the aircraft on land and then the unique operating characteristics of the aircraft on water.
Right, and that makes sense.
So that one did. The tailwheel was there right along.
Right.
And so if the aircraft has the tailwheel configuration, we'll need an endorsement for that. Now, that, again, is the same as general aviation. And the unique thing here is that the tailwheel endorsement starts at the light sport aircraft and goes all the way up through aircraft that up to but not including type-rated aircraft. I mentioned the DC-3. It has a type rating, but you get the general idea that the tailwheel endorsement starts at the LSA, goes up to but not including the DC-3.
I just love that fact. I mean, if you could do a tailwheel on a, tiny little ultra-lightish type airplane that will carry you all through through everything up shy of a type rating.
And for most pilots, that's when they discover, I say this tongue-in-cheek, most pilots, that's when they discover the use of the rudder pedals.
There you go.
So,
not just for turning around at gas pump.
Yeah, no emails, please.
Yeah. and if you do, I'll, should I give them your address?
Yeah, right. And now the last one, and this really is the one that goes to the heart of light sport.
Mm-hmm.
And that is if the aircraft has a top speed, or what's called VH, greater than 87 knots, then there are some additional training, I use that in quotes, versus an aircraft that is less than 87 knots, which is the low mass, low energy, I think we're referring to it now,
right,
type of aircraft, all incorporated within the light sport rule.
Mm-hmm.
And now an endorsement is required for the greater than 87, and an endorsement is required for less than 87. Now, that was always there if you dug into it, but now that's the dividing line in terms of making sure that that's there.
Now, everything you've talked about before, like you say, has already existed in the rules. This 87 knot, which I prefer to think of it as 100 mile an hour, but
okay,
that's where I come from. But it's written as 87 knot. Is that just carry? This is an example. Something is just carries through Sport Pilot, or is that carry anywhere else?
The Sport Pilot rule is the only one that has an airspeed endorsement that I'm aware of.
Okay.
I can think of.
Okay, and I mean, I think that's because everything else you've mentioned is, you know, it's covered everywhere. This one's kind of unique to sport aviation.
Here. Right, and what this the where this the roots on this one when the as people will remember, the Sport Pilot rule was an attempt on the ultralighters' part to get some changes made to Part 103.
Right.
And this became a significant case of be careful what you wish for.
Isn't that the truth?
And at that point in time, everything that we were, again, that excuse the exception, but everything that we were flying had 100 miles an hour was way at the top end.
Exactly.
Now, as Sport Pilot itself has grown, there has become a top end to this thing, to the rule, and 100 miles an hour being that rough dividing line,
mm-hmm.
And more manufacturers have come into it, and now we have LSAs that have glass panels, have autopilots, have better GPS and radio equipment than I think 80% of the general aviation fleet.
Right.
And so we definitely have an aircraft that's out there that is different than the tube and fabric aircraft that had a 503 or a 582 if it was an extensive aircraft.
Well, and generally I have to think that there aren't too many 100-mile-an-hour aircraft, really. I mean, it's certainly a distinct line in the sand, but it seems that most of the high-end stuff, they don't stop at 100. They're going to go all the way up to whatever it is, 120 knots, and they're going to cluster near that top because that's a regulatory cap. And then the folks that are flying slower stuff, it stays pretty well below 100 mile an hour. I mean, if you get an open cockpit thing, you're not going to want to get too close to 100 mile an hour. And I'm sure there's plenty of exceptions. All emails forward those to Jim Sweeney.
Yeah, right. Well, and that's what makes the 100 mile an hour a good designation. If you're going to try and divide this as to where is additional training required and where is it not required,
right?
Then that's a pretty, because of what you've just said, the clustering at the top end or the clustering below, below the 100 miles an hour, that makes it a good division point.
Yeah, we got a good demilitarized zone there.
Yeah, and the need to have it was discussed quite a bit. Where the line was drawn, that never seemed to be a point of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
That element, but the fact that yes, these were going to go faster. Yes, they are going to, may require additional training because of the speed was absolutely there. So the logbook endorsement saying that it's definitive now that you have to have one and or both endorsements. So that if you are below it, you're going to need the endorsement. If you're above it, you're going to need the endorsement. If you're doing both, you need both endorsements.
Now, generally, the guys who are already trained, which is, or already have licenses, there's certainly a lot more of those folks than there are folks at this point, looking in. I mean, certainly over time, there's going to be a whole lot more new guys than there are guys right now. But the guys right now, what do they do? Do they have to do anything here?
No, there's the grandfather is in there for them.
Okay.
And the rule specifically says that if you have time, logbook time, prior to the date of the rule, this change, then you do not need the endorsement.
Okay. Good.
So you've already, what it's taking advantage of is that you already have it.
Okay. Exactly.
You don't
okay.
need to, and particularly, see, you needed the endorsement for the higher, the greater than 87. They didn't specifically say you needed one for lower than.
Mm-hmm.
Students henceforth will need one for lower than and if they're going to fly faster, then they're going to need one for higher than. Guys that are already flying lower than 100 miles an hour and never got the high-speed endorsement because they didn't need it, they do not need to go back and get the low-speed endorsement.
Okay, good. Good, good.
That takes care of the paperwork there.
You can see a lot of people, oh, shoot, they changed the rules. I got to go back to an instructor or next time I do a flight review. And that's just not the case at all.
Well, and you just mentioned the operative phrase there. In a lot of this stuff, the flight review is a perfect opportunity to turn around and increase your level of expertise, your training. People go out and do things like get a tailwheel endorsement and then make that part of their flight review.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody has a low-speed endorsement and it's flight review time, hey, maybe it's an idea to take and put a few hours in a higher-speed light-sport aircraft.
Sure.
Get the endorsement, but you're expanding your horizon, you're expanding your abilities, in addition to expanding your ratings with the endorsement.
Exactly, exactly. Let's talk a little bit about 6119, where we're extending from 24 months to 60 months. What's going on there? What's that about?
The student pilot certificate, and this corresponds to the changes to some degree with the medical certificate. Typically, they are tied together.
Mm-hmm.
And for those people requiring medical certificate, if they go to the medical examiner, they get a third-class medical certificate, and they flip it over, and there's a student pilot certificate.
Right.
Well, they expanded the duration of the medical certificate, but never extended the duration of the student pilot certificate.
How funny.
And as a result, your medical certificate was valid longer than the student pilot certificate.
Yeah, and that's completely, I want to put this, I mean, I guess people don't understand looking in, I mean, they think they're going to be a pilot, it's all going to happen in one season, isn't 2 years long enough? And probably for a lot of people it is long enough, but I have seen a lot of people tripped up by that. I mean, they're in the system. The FAA knows they're out there as a student. There's nothing really more to offer other than they're still in student status. But the certificate runs out, and then they got to go run off and get another one.
Right. And so, I mean, for it was a reasonably concise process in the GA world, where the front side was the third class medical that was required for student pilots and solo flight in a Part 23 aircraft, general aviation aircraft. And now that certificate is no longer required for sport pilot, now where do you get the student pilot certificate? And then what's the door? And then so we had to go to the FISDO or to a designated pilot examiner to get the issuance of a student pilot certificate that is required
mm-hmm.
for sport pilot.
And there's a lot fewer of those.
And then you have a lot fewer places to go. And then the element of, well, if I got one and the other expired. So there was a mismatch in the thing, and that just clarified that.
That's great. That's great.
And so now when a sport pilot, a student pilot, sport pilot, gets his student pilot certificate, it is good for the same duration.
Good. We got one more to talk about before we're going to have to move on here. But and this is a little bit of a, I guess, a change in promises, or certainly a change in what was perceived as a promise as far as ultralight training being used or being able to be used toward a higher certificate, or actually to a certificate period. And tell us about that one.
The good and the bad. The first thing is that as the transition was done to sport pilot, the ultralight pilots could take advantage of all the training that they had, the ratings, if you will, that they had in terms of their different levels, the things that they had accomplished, and material in their logbook as it was vested toward the sport pilot certificate.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing when you say the promise, the one thing that we used over and over is that logbook time is logbook time.
Right.
And so it appeared that the total time, if it was logged properly, would be good forever.
Mm-hmm.
And effectively what we've done is we have capped the ability for a sport pilot, excuse me, for an ultralight pilot to use ultralight time that was properly logged as part of the total time in his logbook.
So forever is not forever.
Forever is not forever.
Well, you know, I have mixed emotions about this because on one hand I do know that there are going to be, it is kind of a step back from a promise, but probably realistically, I'm hoping that this isn't going to affect that many people.
The element, I mean, two things happen here. The reality of it is the properly logged portion of it.
Right.
And that, as ultralight pilots, we flew a whole potload of hours,
mm-hmm.
and not all of those went into the logbook. Obviously,
right.
It went into the experience, but not into the logbook. The pilots that made the initial transition from ultralight pilot to sport pilot, that time was utilized during the transition. And if they're going to make additional log on or get additional ratings, you know, they've got the two-year extension. But I think as time goes on, I guess the implication here is that the number of people actually taking advantage of it continues to dwindle.
Right.
As every year goes by. It's a shame to see it go away, but the practical aspect of it is that, you know, 2 years from now, I'm not sure that, except in a few very specific cases, that it's going to have a significant impact.
Right. And, of course, the other thing that kind of tags along with that is if you look inside the regs, subpart J and subpart K, all that transition language that has been in there since 2004 is now gone. Yeah,
right.
The stuff that says, okay, if you're, you know, the thing that had, I guess, all the deadlines, where all the deadlines, you know, ran out,
right.
Last year and the year before, well, now they're run out and now they're gone. And so if you, I mean, actually having stuff in there that gives specific promises that nobody could take advantage of anymore, it makes perfect sense to clean that up and get that out of there.
And January 31st of this past year, 2010, in terms of all of the extensions, the transitions and whatnot, everything's cleaned up now.
Yeah.
Everything has run its course.
Exactly.
And if we have time for one more...
If it's quick.
And that is the amount of time required in preparation for the practical test. I think this one is significant.
Well, you know, and I think that's almost significant enough to talk about on another day, because I think there's a little bit more to that just from some of the thought processes that went in there. So, I mean, we could throw it out there real quick, but I think
Let's do it justice and just say that it's changed. And if you're looking at 61313, there's been a change. Look at the new version of it, and we'll discuss that in more detail next time around.
The extra good news, the teaser here is that anybody who didn't finish up their rating, they had all their training and everything, and they got it finished last year, they're not going to have the big, they're not going to have to work as hard as they might have otherwise this year. So that should make things good. All right, sir. Jim Sweeney from Sweeney Corp right here on the Powered Sport Flying Radio Show. We're going to take our break and be right back.